Stand, please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 075252. Cookeville Regional Medical Center et al. Collins versus Michael O'Levin, Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Case number 075269. Baptist Memorial Hospital, Inc. et al. Appellants versus Michael O'Levin, Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Pittler for the appellants, Baptist Memorial Hospital, Inc. et al. Mr. Klein for the appellants, Cookeville Regional Medical Center et al. Mr. Flungy for the appellee.
All right, Mr. Pittler. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, my name is Sanford Pittler of the law firm Bennett Bigelow and Needham. We represent the Baptist Memorial Healthcare Corporation appellants in this matter. We'd like to reserve 3 minutes, as I said, for rebuttal. By agreement with Mr. Klein, counsel for the Cookeville appellants, I will address the clear and unambiguous meaning of the pre-2006 Medicare disproportionate share statute and its Medicaid proxy. As the Ninth Circuit found in the Portland Adventist case and Judge Robertson found not once but twice below, the Medicaid proxy unambiguously included all inpatient days attributable to individuals eligible for medical assistance under a Title 19 state plan, regardless of how they became so eligible.
Now, we're not looking at that judgment, correct? I mean,
the
judgment we're reviewing is 60B.
Is the by Judge Robertson?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor. Right. However, the questions in this case concern ambiguity,
right,
the clarity of the statutes. The Ninth Circuit's decision in Portland Adventist discusses that issue, because the government in this case has raised exactly the same arguments considered by the Ninth Circuit. I will address the reasons why this court should affirm Judge Robertson's ruling below that Section 5002 of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2006 does not constitute a clarification of prior law, but rather a substantive change in the Medicaid proxy. Mr. Klein will follow and address the fact that Section 5002 does not meet the Landgraf requirements for retroactive application, that the purported ratification therein does not alter that conclusion, and that retroactive application of Section 5002 will result in a due process violation of the plaintiff's vested rights under Title 19. Let me correct that. Under the Medicare disproportionate share statute. Your Honor, the reason why at the outset we think it's very important that you understand the context that Congress intended this disproportionate share adjustment to play in the Medicare reimbursement. This is not, as the government says, simply an add-on payment. This is a component part of the Medicare reimbursement rate established by Congress in its new prospective payment system enacted in 1982. This court explained in its recent decision in In Re Medicare reimbursement litigation that the Medicare Act bases payments for operating costs of inpatient hospital services on preset nationally applicable rates, but those rates are subject to hospital-specific adjustments, including the disproportionate share adjustment, which increases payment rates for hospitals serving a disproportionately high percentage of low-income patients. Thus, the actual rate a hospital is entitled to receive for Medicare inpatient services is made up of the DRG payment and a hospital-specific adjustment to take account of what Congress found to be additional Medicare costs incurred by hospitals that treat a disproportionate share of low-income patients. As such, this case differs significantly from many of the other cases cited in the briefs. In this case, we believe that when a hospital provides inpatient services to a Medicare beneficiary, that hospital has a vested right to receive the payment according to what Congress intended at the time of the service provision.
Well, in this case, as I understand your colleague's brief, we only need to decide that, at least as to the cost reports that have been filed prior to the 2006 amendment, as of that point, you had a statutory entitlement.
Well,
isn't that correct? That's all you need to argue here.
Well, Your Honor, the cost reports at issue are those that cover the period of time for services provided between early 1994 and January 19th, 2000.
I just want to be clear that what this case is about the reimbursement for cost reports that have already been filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
However, with respect to the Baptist Memorial Hospitals, Baptist Memorial of Memphis included in its cost report filed for the 1994 fiscal year the expansion waiver days.
I understand. We're just talking about filed reports.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Do you read the statute that DRA 5002 added a section to before 2006? Do you read that as discretionary with the Secretary whether or not to include the expansion population in the DSH?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
You read it as
the Secretary had no discretion required under the prior Medicaid proxy.
All right. But you do agree then that the DRA 5002A changed it to discretionary.
Absolutely,
with
Your Honor.
The use of the word may.
Absolutely. Congress created the disproportionate share adjustment. Congress can change the disproportionate share adjustment. The question I'm trying to address here is whether that change merely clarified the law as it had always been since 1986, or whether it was a substantive new change to the law. In fact, we believe it was a sea change in the law going forward.
So do you understand the Secretary's argument to be that while the Secretary always had discretion as to whether or not to establish a demonstration program, that once that waiver was granted, there is no discretion as to inclusion in the calculation?
Do I understand the Secretary's argument?
What the Secretary argues in its brief says the Secretary always had discretion.
But I don't believe the Secretary limits their discretion to up to the point the Secretary approves a waiver under Section 1115. I believe the Secretary argues that its discretion to include expansion eligibility populations continues after.
That's what my question was getting at. That's how you read the Secretary's brief.
Right, exactly. Right. And if I may, Your Honor, if we could just stay on that point just for a second. The Secretary's interpretation of this statute in terms of clarification. You know, when I read the statute and I read the legislative history, I ask myself, what's being clarified? I can find no discussion in the legislative history that this is, in fact, a clarification. The only thing that would indicate potentially that it's a clarification is the single word clarification stuck in the title of Section 5002. I'm going to admit that DRA.
Why does that matter? I just don't understand why, whether we call it give it a label of a clarification or treat it as an amendment, which it is, why does it matter?
Oh, Your Honor, I think it's the threshold issue in this case. It matters for several reasons. First, if it is not a clarification, then at the time these hospitals provided services to Medicare beneficiaries in 1994, then the statute, the DSH statute, the Medicaid proxy, as intended by Congress at the time of service
provision,
controls.
Well, that requires us to agree with the Ninth Circuit. You're just saying the law was as the Ninth Circuit said it was, and if Congress changed it, then that can't be a clarification. In other words, we have to re-adjudicate what the Ninth Circuit decided?
No, Your Honor, I believe you don't. I believe you simply need to affirm Judge Robertson. That's what Judge Robertson ruled below.
Well, he did too. He's a district judge, and the Ninth Circuit, he doesn't control, and the Ninth Circuit is not precedent in this court.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. But the analysis... But
suppose we look at the Ninth Circuit and say, well, it's not so clear.
I think that would be an error, Your Honor, because...
Suppose we look at the Ninth Circuit and say it wasn't so clear back then.
Your Honor, if you find that the statute was ambiguous, then the question remains, was Congress attempting to clarify a statute that it believed was ambiguous?
If we find that the statute was ambiguous, it is not as clear as the Ninth Circuit, there's no question of retroactivity in this case at all, is there?
I apologize, Your Honor. Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
If we believe that the Ninth Circuit's decision is open to question, that the statute was not so clear as the Ninth Circuit thought it was, then there's no question of retroactivity in this case at all.
If you rule that the Congress was clarifying...
No, forget about the clarification, non-clarification. Stick with my question.
Well, Your Honor, I think there's something implied in your question, and that may be why I'm not...
There's nothing implied.
You.
I'm just asking you...
Let me
explain it.
Okay.
Maybe put it in even simpler terms. If the Ninth Circuit was dead wrong, that the statute did not allow the counting of these individuals, right, then there's no question of retroactivity in this case at all, is there?
It depends on whether you defer to the Secretary's interpretation of an ambiguous statute.
No.
Your Honor, if you all concur...
I'm saying if the Ninth Circuit was wrong, there's no question of ambiguity because the disallowance of counting these people back before the year 2000 was perfectly consistent with the statute as it existed then. There's no retroactivity question in the case at all.
If these individuals were to be counted, Congress intended them to be counted.
Intended them not to be counted.
Okay, Your Honor, intended them not to be counted, yes. Then if you conclude that, there would be no retroactivity at all. That's
right.
In fact,
okay.
What a clarification
means.
Now,
Mike, the question I asked you was a little bit different, which was if the statute is ambiguous, is there a question of retroactivity in the case? If we think the Ninth Circuit is not correct, that this was clear as a bell.
There is no question of retroactivity if the statute was ambiguous and if you rule that the Secretary's interpretation of that statute was valid.
Well, on that question, on the latter question, hasn't Congress ruled that the Secretary's interpretation was valid?
If Your Honor assigns that much meaning to the word clarification.
No, I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at B. I'm looking at B3A.
But we ratify
the policy regarding discharges occurring prior to January 20th, 2000.
Your Honor, that's why what's being clarified plays a crucial role here. The Secretary argues that what Congress clarified was that the Secretary always had discretion whether to include or not to include. If that is in fact what Congress was doing, that Congress was clarifying, Section B becomes totally superfluous. You wouldn't need any ratification because the Secretary always had the authority to exercise discretion, if that's what Section 5002 is actually doing. It's not what Section 5002 is actually doing. Section 5002 is actually changing the Medicaid proxy in a very specific way that it did not read that way, nor was it intended that way. When Congress created the disproportionate share statute, it did so because it determined that eligibility for Medicaid, regardless of how you become eligible, because eligibility for Medicaid is under a state plan, even under the waiver. There is no separation between a waiver and a state plan. If you look at the waiver statute, is a one-size-fits-all. It's a statute that pre-existed Medicaid. Medicaid was added to the waiver statute in 1985. It's a one-size-fits-all because Congress allows the Secretary to waive only the requirements in the enumerated statutes that set the requirements for a state plan. You cannot waive, the Secretary cannot waive, the payment provision.
Let me tell you how I read B, and you tell me where I've where I'm making a mistake.
Okay.
The way I read B is that the regulations that were promulgated in the year 2000, which permitted the counting of these individuals, those regulations are prospective only. Is that right? That's not point
yes.
one. Yeah, they're prospective only. The for all open cost reports prior to the period January 2000, Congress ratified the policy of not counting those individuals. And that's in 3A. And
I don't believe it's as clear as you think it is, Your Honor.
What other purpose, what other function, other than the one I just described, can that language, including the policy in 3A, serve? What other function could that language serve?
I think it serves, I think Congress is ratifying that prior policy, but only prospectively from 1/20/2000 forward, because the temporal definition here of these regulations
just tell me what you mean by prospective.
Well, they're ratified as of the date of their respective promulgations.
The regulations.
That's 1/20/2000.
Yeah, the regulations are. But Congress, how can the policy of not counting be ratified prospective only, since the policy only applies before the year 2000? How can that be?
Could you say that one more time, Your Honor? I apologize. How could the ratification apply only prospectively?
Yeah, because the policy only applied prior to 2000. So how can it be prospective?
I think it's directly connected, Your Honor, to subsection B2. B2 basically prohibits use of this statute by hospitals to try and reopen closed cost reports.
Right.
If the Congress didn't include that language, then hospitals potentially could argue, as they did in the In Re Medicare reimbursement litigation case and the Monmouth case, that the statute triggered a mandatory reopening because Congress didn't say anything about the policy in place prior to 1/20/2000. So consequently, in order to not have this be used in the same way as HICFA ruling 97-2 was used in, excuse me, Your Honor, I think this is telling me I'm into my rebuttal time. May I finish?
I'm satisfied with your answer, son.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, wait, I've got a question. How do you read the 2000 regulations? The Secretary was very careful to call everything a policy, either pre-2000 or post-2000. As far as I could tell, never uses the terminology of construction of the statute involved or our reading of the statute involved. It's simply the policy. Do you read the regulation as saying that the policy in effect from 2000 on is discretionary? It speaks in terms of hospitals are allowed to do this. It also speaks in terms of our policy before was that they were not to be included. I'm trying to figure out the discretionary language that is added by 5002, whether it jibes with the Secretary's regulation of 2000. Whether that regulation is discretionary or not.
I believe that the Secretary's argument here has been that the Secretary has discretion to include those days or not to include those days.
Okay.
And in the 2000, the regulations promulgated in 2000, the Secretary was exercising his discretion to include those days beginning January 20th, but not January 19th, going backwards for a statute that did not change whatsoever between January 19th and January 20th.
And your position is that's an ultra vires
absolutely
interpretation and therefore regulation.
Absolutely. Except that this statute purports to ratify that regulation so that the Secretary's discretion, which this statute now grants him where the prior statute did not, will be ratified for the 2000 regulations going forward. Mr. Klein will address as to whether that's a proper ratification or not.
All right, let me
but
ask
that's you. What I think Congress was intending to do here.
Let me ask you one other thing about in 5002, and I realize your colleague is going to address this, but in 3A, why do they use the term regarding discharges occurring prior to, rather than the pending cost report or the still open cost report? Because in 2 above, they talk about cost reports which are closed. What are the discharges, the patient discharges from the hospital, or what is the discharge?
The disproportionate share adjustment,
right,
that Congress created in 1986 applies to the payment due to a hospital for inpatient services provided to a Medicare patient. So it's based on the discharge. In other words, each Medicare patient, right, when they're discharged, the hospital is to receive a prospectively determined DRG payment and a hospital-specific DSH payment for the services provided to that patient. So Congress based this on discharges. That's one of the strangest things about the regulations in 2000. They're basically saying that a patient discharged on January 19th, who is eligible for medical assistance in Tennessee under the statewide 10-care program, cannot be included in the DSH calculation, but a patient discharged on January 20th can.
Now, is the way you read 3A together with 2 above it, that for any discharge occurring prior to January 20th, 2000, the expanded population will not be included?
Yes, and the discharges relate to the cost report.
Well, then I'm not sure why we need 2.
I understand, Your Honor. I think this statute suffers from incredible lack of clarity.
Well, I'll ask the Secretary. Okay.
But let me just finish, if I may. Your question about the relationship between discharges and cost reports.
Mm-hmm.
The cost reports at issue here would be those that covered discharges beginning on starting January 19th, 2000, going back to early 1994, mm-hmm, when the 10-care program, which is the only Medicaid program in Tennessee, it's a statewide Medicaid program that has a waiver that operates, the state plan operates under the waiver as Congress has explained in repeated enactments, right? From 1993 to 2003, Congress's own words explain the relationship between a waiver and a state plan. And in 1997, Congress defined the Medicaid proxy we're talking about as including the patients that we are talking about. Thank you, Your Honor. No further questions?
Now, we'll give you some time.
Thank you.
In rebuttal. Mr. Klein.
Thank you.
The
difficulty with the ratification provision is that it turns the notion of ratification on its head. The principle of ratification is when Congress ratifies the action of an agency head that did not have the authorization to act, but whose action implemented a policy permitted by the statute. Here we have exactly the opposite. Everything is being switched. The ratification is authorizing the secretary, who already has the authorization to act under the Social Security Act, to do that which he is not permitted to do under the statute, which is to exclude 1115 waiver days. Under the prior existing statute, those 1115 waiver days were to be included in the Medicare disproportionate share calculation. The result of that is that the ratification provision from subsection B is not to be given, is ineffective. To be provided with any effect whatsoever, because the notion, you don't ratify a secretary's violation of an existing statute. He's already authorized, the statute has its meaning, he's violated the statute. We've never found any case in which a court has ratified the illegal act of a person authorized to act under statute who violates that statute.
This isn't a court ratifying, it's Congress ratifying.
Well, Congress is wrong. Congress put the word ratification in there, but it did not, and I will concede that Congress certainly knows what ratification is, but it did not understand, in our view, exactly what it was doing.
What do you do with the canon of statutory construction? Let's say that these two, A and B, are inconsistent, and I think you think they are. In other words, A makes it discretionary for the first time. It was mandatory before 2000. At the same time, B is saying we are ratifying the secretary's ultra vires or illegal interpretation of this as discretionary. And so they're inconsistent. So what do you do with the canon that if you've got an inconsistent provision, you go with the last in time, you go with B?
Well, B.
Or does it not apply
B,
here?
B would not apply if the provision is cannot be given effect, and there is no ratification case, any place, that ratifies a person who's already authorized to act under the statute to do that which is not permitted by the statute.
All right, but look at the text of 1315A12A. This is the subpart that starts out, cost of such project, and then goes on, shall, comma, to the extent and for the period prescribed by the secretary, comma, be regarded as expenditures under the state plan, etc. Now, this phrase, to the extent and for the period, why is that not language of discretion being given to the secretary?
He has discretion to decide all of that.
No, but the language is shall, to the extent prescribed by the secretary, be regarded as expenditures.
In
other words, the argument in your brief, as I understand it, is that once the secretary decides there's a waiver, it's all or nothing. If they waive for this category, this demonstration project, that's the end of the secretary's discretion.
As to whether to include the associated days.
Yes. Now, what I'm asking you, though, is how does that argument jive with the language shall to the extent prescribed by the secretary be regarded as expenditures? That's the 1315 language.
That language, when put together with the section Title 11 language, requires that once the secretary makes the determination that these, now what's going on here is they're including people who would not otherwise be eligible for Medicaid, and they're paying for those folks to get Medicaid. And it's happening during the period of time that the Secretary has authorized that waiver program. Once those two events happen, then under the Medicare statute, those days are required to be included.
Okay, so I just want to be clear. Are you, in response then, telling me that the way the Secretary has interpreted that language, it has not been discretion as to saying these patient days, suppose there are 100 patient days that are at issue. This language doesn't give the Secretary the discretion to say, well, the hospital may have served these people for 100 patient days, but I am only going to allow 70 of those days to be regarded as expenditures under the state plan. In other words, are you telling me that the Secretary has never interpreted that language that way?
No, I think that's how. I think the interpretation of the Secretary is that while the Secretary can approve the waiver to include these otherwise non-eligible individuals into the Medicaid program, the days associated with the care provided to those individuals should not be included in the Medicare disproportionate share calculation.
No, I understand that. But I'm saying, I just need to understand how...
Whether he has discretion as to how many of those days to include?
Yeah, assuming that there's no dispute about there was actual service given and these people are the people who come within the waiver.
Well, the Secretary has never addressed it in parts.
That's all I'm getting.
It's all out.
All or nothing.
It's,
yeah.
Right, exactly.
All right.
Relative to the ratification issue and relative to Section A, Section B, how do we reconcile all that? I believe there's an explanation that gets us well inside Landgraf, and that is at the time, you have to remember, there was no Senate bill, House bill. The first time this appeared was in conference committee. And apparently, for the first time, the conference committee became aware that the Secretary had adopted a regulation back in January 2000 that incorporated the 1115 waiver days into the Medicare disproportionate share calculation. Now, the problem for the Secretary is the Secretary believes, now, as you've pointed out, that he has the discretion to decide to keep them in or decide to leave them out. But the statute, from his perspective, is not clear enough. He's already lost a case on that point. So he now has actually lost two cases on that point by the time that we're talking about the DRA. So he goes to Congress and says, okay, I've had a regulation that includes these days effective January 2000. What I want is I want some clarification that I have the authorization to do that. It doesn't cost anything. It's budget neutral. This is an appropriations bill. There'll be no additional money added. And so what I want you to do is, in subsection A, give me the discretion to include these days, and in subsection B, ratify everything that I did on January 20th, 2000. Congress's perspective is, if they do what the Secretary has asked, they're maintaining the status quo. The problem is that there's nothing in the record to indicate that the Secretary knew anything about the Portland of Venice case, the Cookville case, interpretations of the statute.
You mean that Congress knew?
I'm sorry, Congress. Thank you. There's nothing in the record.
That doesn't matter. There's a long line of Supreme Court opinions that says that we presume that Congress knows the law. And so you don't need anything in the record to establish that Congress must have been aware of of those cases.
Let me ask you, when you get to the point of ratification, excuse me, Your Honor.
I'm going to follow up on your ratification. Isn't ratification necessarily retroactive? It approves something that's already happened.
That would not be retroactive. It's already ongoing. It's been challenged.
Now, ratification is necessarily retroactive.
But let me go back. Let me go back to the point that we presume Congress knew about it. I thought that was the heart of your Landgraf argument, that the Supreme Court in Landgraf and subsequent cases has said, when we want to know what Congress intended by ratification, It has to be clear. It has to be explicit. We don't presume anything because the presumption runs against retroactivity. So in this case, I thought the relevance of your arguments was under the standards supplied by the Supreme Court that tells Congress, if you want to make something retroactive, here's how to do it. And Congress has done it. It says, we want to make this very clear. This is retroactive. If it doesn't do that, then the courts aren't in a position to presume that Congress knew certain things and therefore it intended retroactivity. And in this case, as I understand your argument, we're left with either taking the language as it is, the way the district court did, or requiring something, as you argue, consistent with what the Supreme Court has required in its retroactivity jurisprudence.
Exactly. And that's why the scenario that in both ratification cases and Landgraf, evidence that Congress knew what the existing statute was must be evident in the case. And what is evident in this case, well, there's nothing in this case that indicates that they had any idea of that the prior existing statute required these days to be included. And in this particular case, the DRA was an appropriations bill that required the vice president to fly back and cast the deciding vote in the Senate, and it only passed by two votes in the House. This was budget neutral, this was not on their minds, and was well under the radar screen.
So when the district court says, even if Congress was wrong in thinking it was ratifying something, hypothetically, where the secretary said, I've always had this discretion, now ratify it, and Congress says, we'll do that. You want us to adopt the approach of the Third Circuit, saying that it's up to the court to decide whether, absent some evidence by Congress, Congress was correct in its assumption that you could ratify a discretionary power of the secretary. I mean, the Third Circuit said we don't care what the title is. We look to see whether law was changed or not.
All right. If you throw it out as a ratification, quote the language, ratification, and just look at what's in here and try and then piece together where we are in Landgraf, you start out with Landgraf that says they want an explicit statement that they intend to retroactively amend the statute. That doesn't appear in either A or B. What you have is essentially, and Judge Robertson went halfway there, but he might have well gone all the way there and said, you know, it's not actually a clarification, and it's not really a ratification. But those two words tell me that Congress intended to retroactively amend the existing statute. And under Landgraf, that just doesn't do it. It just doesn't do it. You can't take two acts that are invalid, put them together, and come back and conclude that Congress knew and intended to retroactively amend the statute.
I asked your colleague this question. I don't really recall what his answer was. I'm going to ask you the same question. What function does the language in 5002B3 serve regarding the ratification of the policy pre-2000 if it doesn't serve the function that the government says it serves?
It cuts off mandamus actions. It's language in there that if it was not in there would make it easier for hospitals to argue under the theory of mandamus that 5002 does not cut off mandamus actions.
Can I just
get the answer? I don't understand. What kind of mandamus actions?
Well, in the In Re Medicare case, the hospitals filed a mandamus action under the theory that the secretary had recognized that his prior interpretation of law was incorrect. And there are regulations that say if the secretary reaches that conclusion, then he should reopen prior cost reports.
But the problem I have with that is that Congress has already taken care of that situation by saying that there's not going to be any reopening of any cost reports. which are closed. So we're only dealing with open cost reports, right?
It says that's the purpose of that of subsection 2 is to preclude the reopening of any prior cost reports as of the enactment of the act, but that is much broader than the language you're looking at. This section.
So let me Judge Rogers has a question for you, but are you saying that 3A means that if a hospital didn't have this expansion population counted, that they can't bring an action because of 3A, they can't bring an action saying that it's pre-2000, that the secretary should have counted this expansion?
I'm saying that would hurt that argument, yes.
Isn't that your case? That's your case, isn't it? The case you're bringing here. You're saying they didn't count it, and now we want it counted.
But in our case, we're not in the closed cost report area. Subsection 2 addresses closed cost reports. We do not have closed cost reports. We have open cost reports. Our cost reports are open. We're entitled to have the appeals. Subsection 2 focuses solely on folks who are not in litigation, don't have any appeals. Rather, they don't have any appeals. They're going in through the mandamus door.
Is that right? A cost report is not closed until all avenues of judicial review are exhausted?
Correct.
I just don't know. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And for hospitals, many hospitals we represent, their reports are closed. The triggering action here is the January 2000 regulation, which we would argue reflects the secretary's recognition that his prior policy under the law was incorrect, and now he's changing it to include those days. Everything Congress did in 502 reflects an inclusion of the days. The secretary included them in his regulations. Section A provides the secretary with the authority to include those days. It allegedly ratifies the January 2000 regulations, and the only purpose for the January 2000 language is to, in our view, is to preclude the mandamus actions. Under Landgraf, what you have is a Section A and a Section B, neither of which require you to put together a puzzle to figure out what Congress intended. And the minute there is that puzzle, that discussion, what does it mean? You've moved on from the first step in Landgraf to the second, which is, well, is there anything to indicate it was intended to be prospective? And while we may argue, but I'm out of time, that there is, certainly under the third step, it's adversely affect these hospitals' rights. And therefore, the result would be that Section 5002 can be applied prospectively only.
All right, now, I want to make sure. I thought your position on 5002B3A was that it was ratifying an ultra-vires interpretation of the statute.
That's correct.
All which right, is, but it, which, I thought in response to Judge Randolph, you said that was to cover, to cut off mandamus actions.
No, that, I think those are two different questions at two different points.
All right, what's the mandamus, cutting off the mandamus? Is that two?
The question was, what is the function of adding that language from the Secretary's perspective? And our answer is, the function of adding that language is to try and cut off mandamus actions. Our position is Section 3A is that it is ultra vires and it is not a valid ratification and is without effect.
Is that a constitutional argument? Is that why it's not a valid ratification? Congress said we ratify it. You say that's not valid. Why?
Because there is no... Because the theory of ratification is that what the person is doing, though unauthorized, is authorized or permitted under the statute.
Where do you get that from?
That's every ratification case that we have cited.
We're not clear whether it was authorized under the statute or not. So,
well, that's a separate question. If your position is that when you look at the statute and you look at the Portland Aveda case and Cookeville case, there's a question in your mind as to whether they're correct, then we're looking at a different analysis. But you still would not be in the ratification area.
You might be in the clarification area.
There
are plenty of cases. I don't know which ratification cases you've been looking at, but there are cases in which judicial officers have been operating without proper appointment, in which event all of their actions could have been considered ultra vires. Law enforcement officers or officers in various federal agencies. And Congress, over the centuries, has passed legislation occasionally ratifying their actions, all of which were ultra vires. Now,
because they didn't have the authority to do what they were doing.
Right.
They didn't have the power.
Oh, okay.
There's a difference between power and whether or not what they're doing is in violation of the statute. If it's not authorized or otherwise permitted by the statute, and certainly there's no case out there in which either authorized or unauthorized, the ratification permits the violation of the explicit mandate of the statute. If Your Honor's position is there is no explicit mandate, it's ambiguous, Portland Venice was wrong, well, then it's not a question of ratification. It's actually a question of clarification. Then you are in the clarification area. But if you believe that the statute was explicit and did require these days to be included, then this ratification cannot be given any force and effect.
All right. I think we're out of questions for the time being.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask you one question just so I get it asked? Do we know from the record whether or not the Secretary has treated the inclusion of the expansion population as non-discretionary since the passage of the 2000 regulation?
As the Secretary required allowed the inclusion of them after 2000.
The language in the regulation is allows, hospitals are allowed. Is there anything in the record that tells us that you have ever, since that regulation was adopted, that you have ever disallowed it?
Yes. In 2003, the Secretary issued a second set of regulations more precisely determining which expansion populations could be included in the DISH, and it allowed some and disallowed some. So the Secretary certainly believed that he and she had discretion at that time.
All right, and those 2003 regs are not addressed, obviously, in the deal.
They're not at issue here. They are actually also ratified by the Deficit Reduction Act.
Right. Are they reprinted in the appendix?
Okay.
The 2003 regs, I don't believe those are in the appendix.
Okay.
I thought those regs excluded certain types of activities.
Yeah,
the waiver would not cover those types of activities.
Well, the Medicaid waiver still covers them. It's just that when you get that sort of a benefit, that person is not counted in the Medicare
that
dish.
Day
that patient
is,
day
is deducted.
Or the patient. I mean, I think some of these apply to large groups of people who have a higher income, some of these demonstration projects. So,
piggybacking on Judge Henderson's question then, prior to January 20th, 2000, had the Secretary interpreted his authority to be discretionary, as I was discussing with counsel for Baptist? In other words, my hypothetical was it's undisputed that care was provided to the appropriate class of people for 100 patient days under this demonstration program, which had a waiver. And has the Secretary interpreted his power under 1315 to mean that either those 100 days are included in the calculation or they are not?
I mean, I think
it's been an all or nothing as distinguished from doing some parsing.
I mean, I think prior to 2000, it was nothing. I mean, the Secretary's policy was that no expansion waiver populations were to be included in the Medicare dish.
But as I understand the record here, it depended a little bit on what the states did. And if the states included those patient days in the calculation, the Secretary, through his designees, was approving it.
I think there was some accounting issues because the states lumped all of these Medicaid and even other types of general assistance state program beneficiaries into a single kind of accounting system and did not differentiate the different types of beneficiaries. So in some states, there were erroneous payments that included the expansion population, erroneous Medicare dish calculations that included the expansion populations and also other individuals. And that led to Secretary issuing a program memorandum in December 1999 that explained the problem and made clear and then the regulations that Congress has ratified here.
So as I understand it, I'm pressing you here just so I'm clear, but as you've heard all this discussion from our questions about what 50002 actually means, and therefore, in my hypothetical question to you, arguably it can't be the type of clear statement that the Supreme Court has required for retroactivity, since we can't figure out what it means. Therefore, your case hinges on our deciding that, contrary to the Ninth Circuit, 1315 was not unambiguous. And because the statute was not unambiguous, therefore, the Secretary could do what it was doing, and there's no retroactivity issue in the case.
I think that's one way the government prevails. I certainly don't think it's the only way.
Can you prevail? If that's one way, can you prevail under 5002 as well?
Yes, I think the district court had it on this point exactly right. I mean, Congress made what it was trying to do readily clear through this provision. Now,
would you agree this is the district court's opinion is the first time there's been a ratification of allegedly unlawful?
And, you know, I don't know that that's true. I mean, I know the Swain case talks about official action that is unauthorized when taken. I mean, I don't know how they disaggregate that. I mean, that seems pretty clear that Congress can ratify an action of this sort. Congress can certainly change the law retroactively. So, I mean, even if it's termed a ratification and you look at it and you say, well, this is actually a retroactive change in the law, the result is the same. Congress has approved the policy
it's
prior
the same
to January
2. Provided you meet the Landgraf test.
Sure. If it's a retroactive change in the law, there has to be a clear statement, and it has to not, you know, violate an independent constitutional
provision.
Can
I direct your attention to 2B2?
Yes.
Okay. I've been trying to think. I hadn't focused on this before, but I've been trying to think of any situation, what situations would require the reopening of a cost report as a result of the ratification in B1. And the only one I can think of would be pre-2000 when this population was counted by mistake.
So you're suggesting that
B2, what I'm suggesting is that B2 necessarily assumes the correctness of your position here, that the language, including the policy regarding discharges, et cetera, for open reports bars counting that expansion population. This is so complicated, but
Congress might have been trying to get at cases that were long over. I mean,
right. But the group of cases that somebody at a hospital would want reopened would not be cases in which the people were counted, right? And the regulations from January on required them to be counted.
I mean, this...
Right? So it's only the only ones that the hospitals would want reopened are ones in which they were not counted.
Yes, I understand your point. I mean, I think what we explained...
The Congress is saying, no, we're not going to have... Even though we've now said that that policy pre-2000 was correct, we're just not going to require, you know, all these things to be reopened.
But why isn't that captured by 3A when it says any discharge occurring before January 20th of 2000 lops it off whether it's closed or open? Doesn't it? I guess the difference between 2 and 3 is 2 goes all the way to the date of the enactment of the DRA.
Yes.
And 3A.
My reading of 2 was an extra, I mean, I read 2 as being a careful, to make sure the secretary wasn't going to try and reopen cost reports in closed cases and then exclude people from periods prior to 2000.
I didn't state that. I think you're right. So if you had a fiscal intermediary that messed up and counted those pre-2000 patients, right, now that the Congress has ratified the policy, it's saying, Secretary, you're not going to go reopen them.
Yeah.
This only applies to open cost reports, ongoing cost reports.
That's the way I...
It's sort of like the line that the Supreme Court follows in retroactivity cases where, in a constitutional adjudication, all cases that are still pending, the law, whatever the Supreme Court decides, applies to them, but it doesn't apply to closed cases retroactively.
I think Congress is certainly drawing a line between that limits the closing of cost reports between applying this in a kind of prospective sense. The cost reports are open. This is still kind of a prospective application of this policy, even though the policy was pre-2000.
Let me ask you, just so I'm clear from the Secretary's point of view, given that the Supreme Court has not backed off on its requirement of a clear statement under the Landgraf line of cases, how would our opinion read that 5002 is a clear statement because of the language in the title saying clarification and the reference of a ratification?
I mean, I think they've...
And, you know, the 2000 regulation, the preamble, discusses a lot of different policies that the Secretary has. But I think in your brief you say, well, there's this citation to 65 Fed Register 3136, and I agree that's certainly correct, but it's 3136
et sec.
It covers all these different policies that the Secretary had, like she wasn't going to go after these hospitals where the...
No, I don't think that's... No. I'm not sure that's the case. The policy that was expressed in the preamble is, and I'll quote, under current policy, these days were not to be included. And I think that is the policy referred to by Congress in the policy regarding discharges prior to January 20th.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other side has taken what Congress saw as sort of a belt and suspenders approach and tried to turn it into something that's unclear.
Is that Landgraf has said, here's how you do it. And that's been on the books for years. And Congress has done it that way, said very clearly. And now we're trying to parse this language. The two sides have come up with arguably reasonable interpretations of the same language. Is that the type of clear statement where Congress said it's supposed to be so clear that it's inevitable that there's only one reading?
Well, I don't think the other side's reading is that reasonable. I mean, we have a reference to a policy.
Well, they say your reading makes certain language in the... DRA superfluous because you don't need some of this language under your reading. If the Secretary always had discretion, if she could always do these things prior to 2000, you know, why is all this language in here?
Well, I mean, the Ninth Circuit ruled that the Secretary couldn't do it, so if Congress wanted to change the policy, it was up to...
Unlike these other cases on retroactivity, Congress made no reference to a Ninth Circuit or any concerns out there that the courts had misinterpreted what it intended, and it didn't even refer to its own previous statement, like in 1997, that inclusion is precisely what it intended.
I don't think that's a fair reading. I mean, Congress explicitly ratified the very policy the Ninth Circuit held was invalid. I mean, I don't know how Congress could be more on point.
But
I don't
the Ninth think Circuit didn't do anything about policy. It interpreted a statute.
Well, it invalidated the Secretary's policy as being inconsistent with the statute. And this Congress ratified that very policy that regarding discharges prior to January 20th, 2000. I mean, the other side's only answer to that is to say it's to limit mandamus claims, but that concedes that Congress meant to ratify the Secretary's policy of excluding those individuals.
Is this really a retroactivity question at all? The law as it's established in 5002 doesn't apply to cases that have already been closed.
We argued in a brief, and I'll reiterate, I don't think this is this case where there's retroactive effect.
It only applies to pending cost reports that haven't been adjudicated or are in some stage of the ongoing process. By the way, do you agree that as long as there's a judicial review proceeding going on, that the cost report is considered not closed?
I think that's correct, although I'm not, I don't know.
Where do
I
you go
say
to
that.
Find the answer to that?
We could obviously file something on that issue if the court thinks it's important, but I think HHS treats them as open while judicial review is ongoing, although I'm not sure they do it. They always do that.
I'm interested in why the Secretary was so careful to use the word policy in this regulation. Do you take that to be synonymous with the statute was discretionary with him or from the beginning? I mean, before DRA, before anything else, that it has always been discretionary whether to include this population.
Yes, I think the Secretary's view has been...
That's what he argued in the Ninth Circuit.
The DISH just did not address this population. It was enacted before there were any demonstration projects. It didn't use language like in later statutes, you know, parenthetical saying include demonstration projects as well as using the language used in the Medicare DISH. So I just think the Medicare DISH did not address this issue, and so the Secretary had discretion to formulate a policy on how to treat those individuals. In 2000...
Well, what gave you that authority then if it was silent? I don't know that I'm understanding your position. What was the Secretary's position with respect to the inclusion of this population before the 2000 regulation?
They were not included.
Well, was that a matter of discretion with him, or did he take the position that it wasn't, that the statute, I thought I heard you just say the statute was silent as to it, and therefore he was free to do what he wanted to do one way or the other?
The statute did not address them. Prior to 2000, they did not include them. That was the Secretary's policy as related in the 2000 regs, and so I might not be following.
And as related, because he lost that Ninth Circuit case, I mean, he was taking that position in the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah.
Where I'm going is this. Assume that the Ninth Circuit was correct. Forget the Ninth Circuit. Let's say we interpret the statute as mandatory, as requiring this population to be included. And as a matter of policy, you decide you're going to take that reading as of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then Congress in the DRA actually changes it by adding the word may and makes it discretionary. If you assume that it was mandatory before. And so Congress changes it by 5002 and at the same time ratifies an interpretation of it that if you assume it was mandatory was wrong.
Sure.
As a matter of law.
Sure. I mean, it's well established that Congress can act retroactively. So by ratifying that policy, even if it was wrong, Congress is making it right. I mean, there's no better indicator of what Congress thinks is correct than the actual law, which ratifies that policy, no matter what you think of it at the, it might be at the time.
I mean, isn't this part of the problem that Judge Posner alluded to in the Packwood case, that where you have these things coming up in the budget process, and in this case, it doesn't come up until you're in the conference committee, and you just don't have the record you normally have. And it's not that the conference committee couldn't have reported out legislation or that Congress couldn't have passed legislation that said very clearly, this is what we intend. The Secretary has always had this discretionary authority, but it just didn't. I mean, that's what we're trying to parse here, because you acknowledge that the record shows that, well, it depended what the states did. So the Secretary never took the position that these states were acting contrary.
Oh, that's not correct. I mean, the states were making mistakes. The states were making mistakes in accounting.
Right.
And those just weren't caught. And so the Secretary's policy was clear, and she clearly stated what the policy was in those 2000 regs. The fact that the
regs, so that's what Judge Henderson, I thought, was focusing on. The preamble is so careful about talking under current policy, revising the policy, but you know that the Medicare calculation is fully consistent with the congressional goals. I mean, it's never a statutory interpretation.
Well, he can't say the statute prohibits me from counting, and now here's my new regulation that allows me to count them.
But I thought your point was the statute was silenced because it didn't address this population.
The statute didn't address it.
That was your answer to Judge Henderson.
The statute didn't address it, but the Secretary had a policy to exclude those.
Now, when you say the statute didn't address it, what do you do with the language in 1315? Where it says if you give a waiver to a demonstration program, then the costs associated with that program are to be regarded as expenditures under the state plan.
Well, that's true, but the Medicare DSH doesn't talk about costs. It talks about whether patients are eligible.
I know, but I assume, tell me if I'm wrong about this, when the Secretary approves a waiver, it is a waiver of a specific program. So the Secretary knows what she's waiving the cost for. I mean, it's not a blanket waiver, is it?
I mean, no, she's waiving a specific program, but the program provides benefits to people who are not eligible under the Medicaid eligibility requirements.
Right, and then I thought this calculation was this proxy for the additional costs that these hospitals incur as a result of serving low-income people who aren't otherwise eligible.
The Medicare DSH is a proxy that keys its applicability to Medicaid eligibility. So, I mean, one issue with the demonstration project is you're now giving benefits to people who are not eligible to Medicaid. So, if to the extent you want a proxy that is somewhat consistent across state lines by in some states having different groups of people who do not qualify under the Medicaid eligibility standards who get benefits because of a demonstration project, you're not having the proxy's not consistent as it could be. Now, I'm not saying the proxy is going to be consistent because Medicaid programs vary very greatly even within.
And in all of the provisions, the operative provisions of the 1315, the Ninth Circuit seems to read out the same language that is contained in 5002 is contained in each one of those operative provisions. The Secretary may waive to the extent that the Secretary wants to, that the Secretary can reimburse costs to the extent that the Secretary wants to. Every one of those operative provisions is a discretionary grant to the Secretary. And the odd thing about the Ninth Circuit's opinion is that they just don't pay any attention to that language at all.
I mean, I certainly agree with that. I think if we're looking for conferrals of discretion, that's a pretty clear one. And it is telling that Congress in the DRA used the same extent and period language. I mean, it's certainly tied to that. That's certainly tied to that language. But
I
do want to stress
your point that, as you say in your brief, this case is so simple that it shouldn't pose any problem for us.
Well,
because they always had discretion, and Congress said you always had discretion, and That's the end of it.
I think it's simple because it doesn't really matter what the old law meant. Congress came in, answered the very question that's in dispute here, and made it clear that it meant it to apply in cases where there's ongoing litigation by applying this policy prior to January 20th and by saying it applied whenever the cost reports were open. So I hate to get too much into the details of what the law meant prior to 2005 since Congress so clearly answered the question that is at issue in this case.
So clearly.
I think you have a belt and suspenders approach. Congress in A is clarifying that the Secretary had discretion, in B is specifically ratifying that exercise of discretion that was exercised in the past. I'm not sure how Congress could have been all that more clear.
Well, let me ask you, in B, Congress says ratification and prospective application of previous regulations.
Well, the prospective application is in conjunction with the ratification. The ratification is of the prior policy. The prospective application is of the policy going forward. And at the same time, that squares with this as a prospective payment system where until cost reports are closed, Congress can change the way the system works. 42 U.S.C. 1304 gives Congress that authority, and in the Supreme Court's POSSE case, the court specified that they're not contract rights. Congress can do things that have clear retroactive effect under that statute without causing any problems. And Landgraf itself focuses on the type kind of vested rights. It says itself that this is not really a concern when you're talking about distribution of funds from the public coffers. We're talking about contract type rights, tort rights, rights that where you do something and then after the fact you now have legal liability for that.
It doesn't say says prospective application of the regulations, right?
Ratification and prospective application of the previous regulations.
Previous regulations. So that's a 2002 or 2000 regulation and a 2003 regulation. There's no question they were only applied prospectively, right? Those regulations.
I mean, they describe.
It doesn't say prospective application of a policy.
That's true, but the when you get into the definition, the regulation is described as the policy that applied prior to January 20th, 2000. And we submit that just has no meaning unless you're going to apply it in cases where a cost report is open.
Well, when there's still open cost reports, right?
Well, excuse me?
You only apply it when there's still open cost reports.
I mean, and that's another factor. I mean, Congress has a temporal limit. It says when cost reports are open. I mean, when they're closed, you don't apply it. I mean, that's the sort of reaching back temporal limit that I think I submit is clear. If their cost report were closed, it would clearly not be within the ambit of the statute. But the cost reports here are open. And so that B2 comes in as well to show that Congress meant to reach this case.
Going back 12 years.
Well, I mean, the nature of these
at issue in this case.
Yeah, I know. I don't disagree. I think it's 13 years.
Well, I'm saying Congress acted in 2006, going back to 1994.
But, I mean, Congress acted within a year of the Portland Adventist decision. So
no indication that, you know, it was deliberating about that. There was no indication that Congress thought about these hospitals that had proceeded on one theory based on the Secretary's previous actions or not.
Well, I mean, it's a strong indication that Congress addressed the exact policy that Portland Adventist invalidated. I don't know how that could be less strong.
It could be just as counsel described it. It was, you know, a cost-neutral issue. The Secretary goes up and makes a pitch to the conference committee member, and the conference committee says, we'll take care of it.
By ratifying the policy prior to 2000?
In other words, it's an inside deal here. It isn't as though there were Senate and House bills where people could testify and put their case before them. This is just before the conference committee.
It's a statute passed by Congress.
It's a statute passed by Congress. The question is it the clear language Congress uses where it says this shall apply to all pending cases or whatever?
Well, I
And that question doesn't turn on whether it went through a House committee or a Senate committee or a conference report or how it got into law.
No, so long as the language is clear.
We submit the three things. The fact that Congress called it a clarification, it must have thought, as the district court explained, that it was going to apply to all cases, present, past, and future. It specifically set a cutoff date when cost reports are closed, and it specifically endorsed a policy that applied only in the past, which would make no sense if it did not intend the law to apply to a past time period. Another completely adequate answer is that there's no retroactive effect. This law is prospective looking in the sense that it only affects cases that are still open, cost reports that are still open.
Can you think of any other function that language in B-2-3 would serve other than saying that it apply that old policy to all pending cases involving pre-2000 projects?
The answer that the other side gave, that it meant to only cover mandamus cases, is just not adequate because of B-2, which applies it only to, says it does not apply to closed cost reports. So I think when you get beyond that, the other side is accepting that the language meant to adopt this policy excluding expansion populations for periods prior to January 20th, and that would just mean nothing if it didn't apply to any case that arose prior to the enactment of the law.
Is your new policy really so much a new policy? I mean, under both the old and the new, it was within your discretion. You're simply exercising your discretion in a different
way. It's more clear now that Congress has explicitly conferred that discretion.
Well, what I mean is you talk, not just you, but the statute and your reg and everything else talks in terms of policy, but you're really talking about how you're going to exercise what you think is discretionary and what the Ninth Circuit thought was not discretionary.
Yes. And I see my time is up. On the retroactive effect point, very quickly, you also don't have the sort of reliance, the sort of settled expectations, or the lack of notice that Landgraf was concerned about. And finally, even if there is retroactive effect, as long as the court thinks the statute meant to apply to past time periods, it still will apply unless there's a due process violation. And we submit that correcting mistakes is an ample reason for Congress to have given the statute the cutoff, the time frame, the retroactive application that it did here. That combined with protecting the public fisc and reliance interests that were stronger than the ones that the hospital claims that they have.
What's the mistake that Congress is correcting?
I think you could look at it two ways. Congress was either trying to correct an error in its original drafting because it meant to give the Secretary discretion, but that's not the way the Ninth Circuit interpreted it, or it was intended to correct a mistaken ruling. So I'm not sure. Either way, that's a rational conclusion for Congress. I think the Carlton case, the Supreme Court, talks about correcting a mistake in the original provision that would cost billions of dollars. That's sort of the model for what we have here. Even if you view Congress said, we didn't mean to do that, but our language, wasn't very helpful to the Ninth Circuit, so we're going to correct it.
All right. Thank
if there are
you.
No further questions, I encourage the court to affirm.
Mr. Pittler, I know you don't have any time left. Why don't you take 2 minutes and address the non-DRA issue, which is what you were arguing. Isn't that correct?
Okay. Yes. Judge Randolph, I think, with all due respect, I think you misunderstood the Ninth Circuit's decision with respect to Section 1115 or 1315, whichever one you would like to do.
That's entirely possible.
If I may.
Yeah.
If you have it in front of you, it would make it easier.
I have it.
Okay. This section, okay, allows the Secretary to waive only certain sections in certain specific programs identified in the waiver statute. It pre-existed Medicaid. It pre-existed many of the programs. And what this section allows you to do, and we'll take the Medicaid statute as an example. The Medicaid statute, 1396A, is the statute, the provision that sets out the requirements that a state plan must meet. If you look at Section 1115, it allows the secretary to waive some of those requirements.
Right.
Okay? And the extent...
Where to the extent and for the period.
Right. Once he decides to waive it, I'm going to waive it for a year, okay? Mm-hmm. You're going to waive it for a year? That year, it's waived. And there are different requirements substituted as
What do you do with to the extent? That's the period. For the period, 1 year, but to the extent.
To the extent is referencing not the Medicare DSH statute, it's referencing Section 1396A. Which are the ones that you're going to waive? 1396A has 25 or 28 different subsections.
Right.
All that's waived under the 10-CARE program are the eligibility requirements.
The state has eligibility requirements. The secretary can waive them to the extent and for the periods that the secretary determines, right?
The statute has eligibility requirements. Section 1396A has specific eligibility requirements.
Well, the state's program has been approved by the secretary as meeting the statutory eligibility.
Exactly.
Yeah, I understand.
The state program prior to the waiver. The waiver completely substitutes for the prior program. The state plan continues to operate, but it operates under the new requirements approved by the secretary under the waiver. Yeah. And the important distinction here, Your Honor, is if you take a look at Section 2. See, Section 1 only allows you to waive those items that a state plan must meet.
And Section 2 deals with cost.
Exactly. Yeah. And the statutes
and also
that
uses
deal
the,
with...
No, also uses the language to the extent,
I take it,
right?
I take... I, excuse... I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't mean to talk over you. Yeah. I apologize. No, it doesn't deal with costs. It deals with payment. Take a look.
Is 3 cost, Section 3?
No, there's only two sections in 1115. We're talking about the waiver statute.
Yeah.
Section 2A deals with the payment for costs.
Oh, 2 deals with costs.
I understand. It deals, you see the sections that are referred to there? 303, 655, 1203, 1353, 1383, and 1396B. Those are the provisions in these programs, these statutes, that govern how you use federal money to pay for costs under the state plan. You cannot waive Section 1396B. 1396B is drafted in such a way, as is every one of these other sections, and I encourage you to have your clerk go take a look at them. It's drafted in such a way that says the Title 19 funds can be used to match care provided under state plans that meet the requirements.
Okay, I appreciate that. Let me tell you where I have a problem with the Ninth Circuit. You know,
sure.
Okay? And you asked, do you have the opinion in front of you? I do. The Secretary argued there that these provisions that we're talking about, particularly A2A and 1, that gave him the authority to determine the extent and period for which costs of benefits provided under a demonstration project shall be regarded as expenditures under a state plan.
Yes.
The Ninth Circuit answered and said, no. Extent and period clearly refers to the scope and duration of the demonstration project and identifies these as matters left to the Secretary. Now, the only reasoning, and then the same thing is repeated later. The only reasoning there is it clearly refers to. Using the word clearly doesn't make it clear. The Secretary had argued that this was ambiguous. It wasn't so clear. The Secretary wasn't saying that the statute absolutely gave him the authority or absolutely deprived him of it. He said it's not so clear. And the Ninth Circuit says, well, clearly doesn't allow you to do that. And that's it. That's the reasoning.
Excuse me, Your Honor. When you say the Ninth Circuit ruled it clearly doesn't allow you to do that, what is the that?
The discretion to not count the expansion population after giving a waiver.
Okay. This statute has nothing to do, is unconnected to, the Medicare disproportionate share statutes dish adjustment factor. This statute is only talking about what happens when the secretary approves a waiver. This statute, especially the language you just pointed to.
You're talking about 1315.
Yes, I am, 2A. If that was not there, the secretary could not use Title 19 funds to pay for the waiver project, to pay for the costs of the 10 care program providing health care to the people who are eligible. And the reason why they couldn't use Title 19 funds is because Section 1390B, 96B, D, C, you could go take a look at them. They all require, they limit the use of Title 19 funds to state plans that meet A. There's no language in there about a waiver of requirements of A.
Yeah, all this is very interesting, but I don't know that it seems to me rather simple. The counting of individuals, the only individuals you count in doing this calculation are those who are eligible. The individuals that you want counted clearly are not eligible. Your argument is that they should be regarded as eligible because the secretary waived the requirement that they be eligible. Isn't that your argument?
No. No. Because the way you are putting it is you are divorcing the waiver from the state plan. Mm. The DISH statute says eligible for medical assistance under a state plan approved under Title 19. The waiver is not separate from the state plan. Your Honor, if you go look at what Congress has said, we've quoted it to you in the briefs. In 1993, Congress describes the relationship between a waiver and a state plan as a state plan operating under a waiver.
And I will take another look at it.
I would really encourage you, Your Honor, to look at what Congress said in 1997, because in 1997, in the Balanced Budget Act, Congress specifically states what its understanding of this Medicaid proxy is. Right? It specifically says the Medicaid proxy includes people who are eligible for medical assistance under a state plan, including a state plan operating under a waiver.
Okay. If there are no more questions, I think we've
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Klein? Why don't you take 2 minutes and address the DRA again?
A couple of interesting notes. Relative to Section B2, the reopening language actually applies to cost reports that are closed after January 20th, 2000 as well. It says that clause applies as of the enactment of the Act. So, for example, if some hospital for some reason in 2001 failed to have these days included and the 3-year period for reopening was over, they would not be able to use Maine Amos or any other effort to have those years reopened to include these days. So subsection 2 breadth goes right up to now. And becomes effective as of the effective date of the Act. An additional point is that the reason this is retroactive is that a change in the law doesn't automatically apply to pending litigation. A change in the law may not apply if the effect of that application has a retroactive effect. If it changes the legal consequences of acts contemplated or completed before its effective date, that's out of Landgraf. So the fact that we're in litigation, if that were the law, that a law is passed, you're in litigation, you're subject to the law, there would be no reason for Landgraf. And finally, as to the the clarity of the secretary's policy, I would note that at page 42 of the secretary's brief, and basically what he says is, we really didn't have a policy prior to January 20th, 2000. What we had was unclear guidance. And in January 20th, 2000, we clarified that guidance. What it says is the hospitals argue that the pre-2000 policy was not clear. This is out of the secretary's brief. The hospitals argue that the pre-2000 policy was not clear because the secretary acknowledged in the preamble to the January 20th regulations that our prior guidance on certain aspects of our Medicare DSH policy is insufficiently clear. But Congress referred to the secretary's policy described in January 20th regulations, not the admittedly insufficient clear guidance prior to those regulations, on and on and on. But the point is, and it does go on and on and on, the point is that prior to January 20th, 2000, there was no clear policy. Indeed, the first time that the secretary put pen to paper to try to explain his position was on December 31st, 1999, when he said, by the way, I'm not going to include these days anymore. If you've gotten them, fine, I'm going to leave you alone, but we're not going to do it anymore.
You're making a leap that because the guidance, and guidance is usually documentary advice that an agency puts out, as you know, and because the guidance wasn't sufficiently clear, maybe it wasn't clear enough, that the secretary had no policy. They're two entirely different things.
Well, if the secretary is saying that they're not talking about the guidance, then he should be telling me what the policy was at that time, not what the policy is for the first time in the regulations.
Well, what do you say to counsel's point in response to a question I asked, that prior to January 20th, 2000, where states were including these patient days, that was contrary to the secretary's policy, but these erroneous inclusions simply weren't caught. Had they been caught as an accounting matter, the amount of the reimbursement would have been deducted.
Well, I think that is an assumption on the secretary's side. There are some fiscal intermediaries who believe that those days should be included, and there are others who believe they should be excluded. And unfortunately for Tennessee, they believe they should be excluded. And that's why you have Program Memorandum 99-62 in December 31st, 1999, which for the first time says, okay, we're going to lay out what our policy is. There's nothing in writing before then from the secretary stating, here's my policy. Mm-hmm. In any event.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. it's